Because adversity is often the breeding ground for development. Dive into neurointerventional stories, the uncensored interviews. Our guests, all leaders in the field of neurointervention, share the difficulties they face, the complications they have had to manage, and speak without filters on little discussed, sometimes controversial, or simply taboo subjects. Hello, my name is Nantia Suchichantrarat, and today I am pleased to welcome Dr. Marcus Holtmannspotter. He has allowed me to butcher his name because I couldn't do it in a German way. I apologize. Dr. Holtmannspotter, how are you today?
I'm very fine, and no worries about my name. You have a very good pronunciation of that one there. So, no, thanks. I'm happy to be here and looking forward to this conversation.
Thank you. So can you briefly introduce yourself in a few words and your background and training?
After university, I wanted to become a neurosurgeon. There, I started training in neurosurgery in Munich and by accident ended up in neuroradiology, where I got stuck and became, after 14 years in Munich, training as a neurointerventionalist. I went to Copenhagen for another 8 years there at the university, and since 4 years, I'm head of neurointervention and neurodiagnostic imaging in Nuremberg Hospital in Germany.
Clearly a very long and accomplished career. We're going to ask you the same question that we always start with, which is that what would you say are the biggest professional difficulties that you have had to overcome in the course of your career?
So that's not so easy to answer, yeah. So sometimes things happen to you, yeah. So I ended up more or less by coincidence and interest and, okay, have a look there. And I ended up in a very good department for neurointervention. The problem what I see there, or what I would caused me a delay, was it took a long time before I was allowed to use a microcatheter, and I was always gaining more passive experience, which is valuable too, yes. But I think you can cut down the learning curve a lot if you get the practical stuff earlier on, yeah. So you're not alone. You can get trained by your consultant. And I think there was a big lack of that, yeah, so without me noticing in the beginning. What I noticed as being the second factor for not advancing as fast as it would be possible in a good way, not being hasty, I think I should have been exposed to more teachers in other hospitals, yeah, so after having accomplished my training and then getting hands on some devices early on, I started proctoring, and so I went to other hospitals in Germany, in Austria, and later on internationally, and it's amazing experience. Yeah, so they're specialized in all the other places, and to go there and parenthesis as no better, kind of, but only for that device feels sometimes weird, especially if you go to centers where you have very experienced people which you're looking up to and have to tell them what to do. But that's just the emotional part of it. The objective part of it, there was no proctoring where I didn't come home with a new idea how I could behave differently, yes. And, you know, I got many years of training. I never left Munich, and this was navel of the world, yeah. So, yeah, you need to look beyond the horizon and have a good exchange with other specialists. That's super helpful.
So I have two comments in follow-up of what you just said. One was that how was your experience being a trainee? You know, you mentioned you feel that you should have gotten a lot more practical stuff early on. How has that experience changed the way you train a trainee today? Or has it?
It has, yeah. So one thing is, of course, workload is nice to share, yeah. So if you don't leave others get hands on, it's more difficult the longer you wait, I think, personally, yeah. So proctoring helped me a lot because that means you stand in the second line. You're not allowed to touch the device. You need to formulate what you think, what you usually feel with your hands. You need to put it in words, sometimes in different language, yeah. So native German speaker explaining stuff in English is a good training to reflect what you do, yeah. So if you're only working by yourself, that's not enough, to my opinion, to get a real level of proficiency. I think there's a big gain in proficiency if you're forced to tell your experience, to formulate it, how to do it, and working together with a resident now is great. So I try to step back and try to do these things what I did in proctoring with my residents and teach them from the beginning. Yeah, so they learn very fast to do angiographic diagnostic imaging for cerebral vessels and then different levels. Okay, you start first with thrombectomy. So, but there's not like I was told, first I have to do at least 1,000 diagnostic cerebral angiograms before I might get in the near of the microcatheter. So I think that's it's helpful to have a lot of experience, but you get a better feeling of the material working together. So it definitely changed my practice. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot I think that we do in our field, just like any field really, that we do by feel. And so sometimes it's really difficult to tell somebody who has less experience, I can imagine, how it's supposed to feel in your hand. And even with my mentor, Dr. Matuk, when we do a case together, sometimes I'll just tell him it feels wrong. I don't know what it is, but the catheter feels wrong in my hand. Can you come in and take a look? And I think that being able to gain enough experience and knowledge is one thing, but being able to articulate what you're going through in each of the steps is like a different kind of skill set altogether. Like you said, proctoring has brought that out of you.
Yeah, but it brings safety to the treatment too. Yes. So sometimes you have it with a trainee, sometimes you have it with a colleague. Yeah, so I remember in Copenhagen, a very good friend of mine, Mats Kronqvist, yeah, so experienced neurointerventionist. Then he comes by and looks, oh, why are you doing that? Yeah. And a question which puts you off, you're just focused on doing stuff. Yeah. And he just had a short view and was daring to comment. Yeah. So, but I have to step back emotionally and say, okay, if I can't answer his question, maybe my strategy is wrong. Yeah, so I should have an answer for that. So it's also a control of your strategy and what you're doing. If you can word it, if you can formulate it, why you're doing it. And I think that adds also to some safety. Yeah, so, you know, there's some old traditional angiosuites around the world where there's no talking. Yeah, so... Well, maybe I talk too much sometimes, yeah, so I tell some proctoring, yeah, so it just stop me talking if I annoy you too much. I know I'm talking a lot of redundant stuff because there are no beginners usually, yeah? So, but I think explaining the strategy is extremely important.
Yeah. The second follow-up question to what you said in the beginning was that you wish that you had travel around and see other people more when you were in training. Do you think there's any role in our trainees in different specialty to do rotations with other specialties? Meaning that, you know, if you are radiology trained, you want to be interventional. Should you go rotate with a neurologist and neurosurgeon and vice versa?
Definitely, I think that. Yeah, that should be mandatory. Unfortunately, in Germany, the criteria have been changed, so it's not mandatory anymore. Yeah, so when I was training and wanted to become a neuroradiologist, I had to have 1 year clinical experience in either neurology or neurosurgery. Yeah, so that was not an issue because I started in neurosurgery. But it's such an important interface to have some insight. You don't need to be specialized in that field. If you've been there and you work with the colleagues, you better understand their needs and vice versa. So I think it should be mandatory. And without this, a good interface, we don't make good work.
So I want to focus a little bit more on what I think is a very unique aspect of your career, which is that you have the opportunity to really use a lot of devices before, at least before we get it in the U.S. for sure, because things are much slower in the U.S., and you get to work with a lot of new different technologies. There's got to be, you know, both the perks and the difficulties that come with the integration of new technologies all the time, both in your practice and the training of your trainees. Can you comment on that a little bit and elaborate?
Yes, I think I'm a little bit of a gadget guy, so if I get a new toy, I think
aren't
it's very exciting.
Us.
Yeah,
yeah.
But these new devices have had a special purpose being developed, yeah, because there have been difficulties in treating some kinds of aneurysms, some kinds of AVM fistulas, maybe access or implant. And so it's completely different than from an iPhone, which nobody was aware that it's needed sometime now. We can't live without anymore. But these devices have created new opportunities and relief, how we better have a tailored treatment from that. And so it's very exciting being among the first and having a new tool. But there's also a learning curve which needs to be done. And sometimes we have been surprised, like with the flow diverters, the giant, the serpentine, fusiform aneurysm, which are still not perfectly treatable with those devices, with the flow diverters. But they opened a new field and they took part of the business, which was for coiling only before. And then one device is good. And then concurrence develops new devices similar to that, which helps a lot because there are some cutbacks, drawbacks. There's always a trade-off. It's more flexible, it's more kickback, it's more stable, whatever. So to find out these nuances between these devices is a challenge and a benefit too, because then you learn also to understand the mechanical, physical spectrum of what you can push through catheters and what difficulties you meet. I think there's a difficult point in diversity. I love diversity, but you know, you need to do a number of X of cases with one device to have a certain level of experience where you can say you're proficient with that. You might be not the best, but you can really deal with the device in a good way. And if you diversify too much, then that creates a problem. Yeah, so you don't even understand the difference between the devices. A high portfolio, a big portfolio, or many options dilute our experience for the single device compared to the time when we coiled all aneurysms, sometimes with some remodeling, a balloon or a stent. And now we have coiling, we have flow diversion, we have many aneurysm stents for remodeling. And then we have now the intrasaccular devices, yeah. So in between there was a little bit of time with liquid embolics for aneurysm, yes, Onyx 500. So how to deal with that if the number of aneurysms stays the same? This is even difficult for somebody who's had the learning curve, yeah. If you translate that now for the training, I think we're on the verge that we have to change our training to adapt to that big portfolio, which is a huge benefit because we can really do tailored treatments. The risk has been cut down. We have a high safety for these implants. Most recent studies have shown most of them. So how can I bypass the lack of experience with the device and cases? My answer to that would be we mandatorily have to integrate simulation training, kind of like not as a gadget, okay, I try this case. So it has to become part of our daily practice. Yeah. So I'm working on getting a simulator for virtual reality with haptic feedback for my department. And the plan is not trying new devices. I want to have my residents on a regular basis. Yeah, each one gets like 2 or 4 hours a month where he has to train on the simulator. I'm completely aware that the simulators are not perfect yet, but they improved a lot. There's another interface which we have to make with the industry, with simulators and training and the societies to implement that in a future curriculum. I think thus we can, because the simulators, they can give feedback. I've done good, I've done wrong, I have finished the procedure, but I did 5 critical errors and I used huge amount of x-ray because I didn't blend in or so. So the simulators can mirror all that, yeah. So, and if you do it on a repetitive way, then you can improve. The next step would be then we can do debriefing of complex cases with the simulator, so doing those cases ourselves. So acquiring skill, maintaining skill, and then I think another next level would be management of complications, because usually complications are super rare, hopefully, and then you're in a dire situation, but you have a rare situation too. So you're under pressure. So if you have the opportunity to train how to deal with a snare, how to get an implant out after you detached it, if it's necessary. So this is what you usually not get trained. You get suddenly in a situation which is pretty unique and you didn't have the opportunity to training. And I think that's the way we have to go. So create proficiency by simulation for this huge portfolio and implement that in the curriculum. Build that curriculum together with industry for even better individualized simulation for cases. Yeah, so we've seen a lot here also in the conference, implant simulation, these flow models, yeah, 3D prints. So lots of efforts are done with that, but it's so on a nice-to-have basis. And I think the societies, we need to find a way to implement those. And it's hard to get industry to invest into studies. It's also it's difficult to do educational studies for training. It's a long study, yeah, so how many trainees do you have, yeah, so... But if you would have more data regarding that, then it would be much more easier.
Yeah. I mean, I would venture to say that there's probably doesn't need to be that much data to convince somebody that, you know, simulation would be beneficial in our field for sure. I've actually, interestingly, a lot of people talk about simulation, but I think you're the first person that said something specifically about simulation for complications, which is such a great idea. Because that's what, you know, that's what we gain by having a lot of cases. We see how we deal with certain types of complications. And so it makes sense that if you can simulate it, learn how to deal with it, learn how to fish out, you know, coil and parent vessel, retrieve a device, rear simulation. Of course, we should do it, right? Mm-hmm. So that makes sense. So let's talk about collaboration with industry. I always love to hear that these answers from you guys. How do you integrate that into your practice, and how do you do so ethically? How do you make sure that that's maximally beneficial to your practice and your trainees?
I think we talked about interfaces already. I don't see any benefit if I have a sales rep coming to my department and selling stuff and leaving again. I encourage industry to stay with my cases, of course, on code of confidentiality and data safety. But I need industry to understand my problems as well as I need to understand what can industry do, where are the limits. So an interaction with industry on terms of R&D, engineers, having direct feedback, the reps coming to my house, they see a lot of houses. Yeah, so if they spend time there and there, of course they don't talk about the other houses. Yeah, so but those reps accumulate in their time a very widespread knowledge. So they know, okay, they do it there in a different way, and some valuable tips and information can derive from that. And so I like to build up trustful relations between my sales reps and my department. And we share also our problems, not only as a complaint, but we discuss about that. And I have a good feeling about that, because then they also get an understanding that's not always their own product, which is necessarily the best. Yeah, so in many years, I not really have experienced a real issue with different companies and say, no, they there, yeah, so if you want to be nice, then you use their product. So no, they're completely relaxed about that. So, which is also good if you're looking on a long-term basis, having a trustful relationship. And the other thing is R&D, yeah? So if you use a lot of different devices, you get also some ideas what you want to have differently. So, and if you don't have that interaction with the industry, it won't change anything. I think the industry, they need not my feedback alone, but feedback from many physicians, because there's not one thing which is right only. It's always a trade-off, and they have to make a decision which product quality they like to improve or what safety issues they have to address. I think for a successful patient treatment, we definitely need a good relation to industry. I think the biggest issue is to keep the right balance. So I need concurrence. So if I have one company who's giving me product which is just unique, okay, then that's yeah, but the majority of the products, they strive having concurrent products which just have a slight twitch and maybe can engage better with the thrombus or have a little bit more stability across the aneurysm neck or less recurrency. But it's not always the right thing. So there might reasons to switch to another product, because then it's a trade-off, because access anatomy and so. So the versatility is amazing, but it only works with good cooperation with the industry. I think what's important is transparency. Yeah. So 8 years in Copenhagen, yes, I would always have to declare all my work with industry in the intranet. So available, open to everybody. Yeah. So.
Same for us.
Yeah, so I think that's absolutely important. Yeah, so I have a little bit issue with the. I think that compliance is super important, but in some ways it's overdone. Sometimes compliance is suffering for being over compliant, because then there's some mechanisms are invented to be compliant on the paper, which make the whole system less transparent. I'm not a specialist in that. I'm just kind of annoyed with the amount of paperwork I have to deal with.
Obstructive. I think that's the word. Yeah. Sometimes over-compliance becomes obstructive to new technology at times.
Exactly.
So as what sounds like you are an early adopter of most technologies, how do you balance that with the uncertainties of outcome?
That's another trade-off. So, of course, if you have good material for standard treatment, and then you get a new toy, how is it ethical to use that in the patient? One thing is, of course, the consent. So you should be open what you're doing. The other thing is, do you expect an advantage? Okay, and then is it labeled? Of course. But there's one interesting thing about the label stuff. So many years ago, I had a discussion with a German lawyer in the society meeting, and he was talking about off-label use. Given that there's a CE mark or FDA approval for a certain product, which is new on the field, I think we need to rely on our experience. And that was what the advocate told me. Actually, if I'm against my experience, don't use something off-label. I'm reliable for it. So if my own experience tells me in the best interest for the patient, I should deal with that off-label, because that's the best for the patient as far as my experience and knowledge goes. So now I have to do it off-label. So my experience is set above the labeling. The labeling is industry safety margin. So it's a lot of personal judgment in the beginning, and communicated in an open way with the patient, relatives, and also the hospital. I think it's a very good thing to do. But there's responsibility with it. I try to comply with it, responsibility in acquiring data. So, okay, if we do it, we should also document it. And I'm favoring kind of like putting every new device in a prospective registry, at least. So I'm aware you can't do randomized trials on everything. And this is also sometimes against when you think this is definitely the best. If you don't have equipoise, you can't randomize anybody. Yeah. But new devices tailored to your needs, because you know with the classics treatment, some things were difficult. Yeah. And so if you see a benefit, use it, but do it in a registry.
So there has to be a need that needs to be filled, and not just a switching of product for the sake of doing new things.
Yes.
So to speak. You know, I think at least in the United States, our field is so unique in that to get on label for something, it takes so long, that to be off label or to use something off label is not necessarily meaning that we are doing experiments on people. For example, pipeline, the label used is still the ICA aneurysm of a certain size, and we have wide experience using it with everything else. And so, you know, if we have to, I think the regulatory component of having to disclose everything, or having the patients taking that as an experiment, is also misrepresented, because we feel perfectly comfortable using pipeline in other locations and other sizes.
Yes.
Right.
Completely agree.
Yeah. So we're nearing the end of this podcast, so we're going to ask the same four questions that we ask everybody, which is, the first one is that if we could go back 10 to 15 years, what would you do differently in your career? Or you can choose to answer what our field should have done.
Yeah, just what I said in the beginning. I should have traveled more in the beginning, and I should have been more proactive also with my director about it. Yes.
And then if we fast forward 15 to 20 years, how do you imagine the field will evolve?
Well, the field is growing seriously, and I think we will implement much more AI, much more simulation. And I'm not so much a fan of remote treatments via robotics, but I think that robotics will be part of it. And that'll come like driving assist systems with a car. you know. So where, because the learning curves are much shorter, the diversity of products besides simulation, I think we are not able to acquire the full spectrum of haptic feelings throughout the procedure, from slide to maximum disaster and joy. And robotics is able to bypass that. Yeah, so just control small errors, yes, or making intervention more safe. Some people say, okay, well, remote treatment is great. Yeah, so yeah. I don't see that coming. I don't know how. You need also a team to supply the robot and feed it, kind of. So the interface human with the robot in a remote center with less experience is not so good. Maybe two experienced center having specialists in different areas. That might be an option. I think that we will see a lot of that.
The implementation certainly still has a lot to figure out on that aspect. So if we now turn attention, actually you sort of answered this question earlier, to the training of any interventional person coming out, what do we not do enough for the trainees today? And it sounds like for you, simulation.
Simulation, yes, yeah. And more consequent sharing of cases. So doing the cases together, even there's a usual workload of the day, and just leaving the resident alone because the desk is piling up is not the best option. So I think it's not, I leave them doing it alone, but I share, and one pair of eyes is focused and the other is more widespread. I think that's
well said. All right, so we have discussed several difficult topics, so we're going to end on a more positive note, which is that in the past months or years, what do you think has been the highlight for our field? Interventions, people, initiative, anything you can think of?
It's all of it.
Yeah.
No, I love the development of the field, and I also, you know, it's amazing. So the percentage of possible complications and dire situations has dropped dramatically over the last 15 years. And I see this as a common success from good interaction between clinicians, interventionalists, industry. Of course, also the patients who have to trust us. Yeah. So, and there are many patients always who have also not the good outcome. Wouldn't forget those. Yeah. But that's the decrease in the complication rate and the increase in safety. That's the most amazing development over the last 15 years, I think.
Certainly. Completely agree. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Holtman-Spotter, for spending the time with us today.
Thank you very much. It was a big pleasure. Yeah, I don't try to pronounce your name. I would need a half an hour extra training.
Thank you.